Well, good morning to all of you. It is a lovely day. I'm very privileged, of course, to be able to speak to you, God's people, and are very thankful to be here on this peaceful Sabbath day, enjoying the beauty of this land and all the blessings that God has given us here. We reflect on some of the terrible circumstances happening in the world. We know that Japan has just been walloped with an unbelievable situation, and a lot of people are suffering there, and it's a terrible state. I just learned this week about a horrible situation, a terrible situation that happened in Israel this last weekend, last Sabbath actually. I guess it was on the evening of the Sabbath, Friday night, in Israel, actually in the West Bank or Samaria, the northern part of the West Bank. There's a family, the Fogel family. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Okay, there was... just to reiterate that, though, there was this family with six children, and the father was a rabbi of this community. Of course, it's a West Bank settlement, so they were very much opposed by the Palestinians there, and terrorists came in and slaughtered the parents, the father and the mother, and three of their children, of their six children. The 12-year-old daughter was gone visiting with some friends at the time, and she came back and she couldn't get into the house, and so she went to a neighbor, and they came over to try to help her get in, and I guess they busted something in and helped her to be able to get in. So then she kind of came in and thought, well, everybody must be sleeping, so she went in, and then she found a gruesome scene. This little 12-year-old girl found this horrible scene. Her father was all bloody and dead, her mother, and her two of her siblings were dead, a 4-year-old and an 11-year-old, and then also a little 3-year-old or 3-month-old girl, a baby, that was it was just horrible. I won't even describe what was described. And it's just absolutely mind-boggling, and it has rocked Israel, and it is just an utterly heinous situation. But of course, right after this happened, it was announced in the news, and I mean, you had, I guess, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, did come out and say, you know, this was horrible, animals, only animals would do this. Yet, in the Gaza Strip, under Hamas control, they were passing out candy. And they were just thrilled. You know, if this brings back the whole images of what happened after 9/11. They were passing out candy and cheering and dancing in the streets. Absolutely horrific when we think about these things that are going on. And but that little 3-month-old baby was, you know, pulled from her parents' hands and just and gruesomely slaughtered. Just absolutely terrible. The little baby's name was Hadass. And it's the same basically as the name Hadassah, Myrtle. And that kind of brings to what I want to talk about today. Because Hadassah is a character in the Bible. And we often know her better by the name of the book that is written about her, the book of Esther. And her real name is Hadassah. And the reason I want to talk about that today is because tonight, as soon as the Sabbath is over, it is the Festival of Purim, would be tonight and tomorrow, as well, and that's around the world, and then also, and then in Jerusalem, they actually observe it on the next day, on Sunday night and Monday. But, and I'll mention why that is here as we go through this, but just these shocking events. You think about what the Jewish people have had to endure through the centuries. And we go back to this terrible situation that happened in the book of Esther when people tried to wipe them out, obliterate them from the earth. And of course, there are many lessons here for us. But today, I just want to give a brief overview of Esther and Purim. One thing I want to mention about Purim is some people reject it as part of the Bible because for a few reasons. One is that it doesn't mention God. It's one of the only books in the Bible that doesn't mention God. Song of Solomon is another one that doesn't directly mention God, although there may be a mention there. But it's also God's name is not mentioned in this book. There's no mention of God on the surface, but there is clearly the guidance and direction of God through this book, through the circumstances that happen, and that's part of the way this is viewed. Esther, her name actually, that name Esther, which is the name she was known to by the Gentiles, is the same as the name Ishtar, basically. And we think, wow, that's horrible. Mordecai, by the way, her relative, his name is the same as the name Marduk, which was one of the gods of Babylon. So you have these very pagan names that they had taken living in that society, and we don't know. These are people that didn't come back at the time of the return. They were still in that pagan land, and maybe they had taken on elements of that culture. But this book is about them standing up for who they are, and finally coming to be bold in that, and coming out of the way of those foreigners. And this is an interesting thing to look at. But another meaning of Esther is in Hebrew. It's interesting because in Hebrew, Esther, that name has a little bit of a different meaning. It means hidden. And so that's one of the, they think that's part of the idea here is that it sort of represents the fact that God is sort of hidden in this story. It's hidden in the circumstances and the things that happen throughout the account. But anyway, just looking through this very quickly, if you would open to the book of Esther, I would want to point a few things out here. Of course, in chapter 1, we have this whole thing of the former queen, Vashti, who ends up dethroned, which creates an opportunity for a new queen to come along. And that's where you see in chapter 2, we have the selection of these other women, and finally Esther becomes the queen of the land. And that itself is remarkable because, again, we might think, well, some people think, well, that's horrible. She's going to be married to this pagan ruler and all this. And of course, that is horrible. But at the same time, these circumstances worked out to where she was in this important position over the realm, and Mordecai ended up also in this important position over the realm that would not have happened had she not been in this position. For them to be able to thwart this evil plan of the devil, basically, to wipe out the Jewish people. And we see at the end of chapter 2, we look here in verses 21 through 23, it says, "In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate," and so he was able to be in an official position because Esther had become a very important person, the queen. And so it says, "Two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus," or Xerxes. We understand that's King Xerxes of Greek history. "So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows." And by the way, when you see that in this context, being hanged on a gallows among the Persians is not what we think of, string them up, by a noose. That's, out in the Old West or something. No, this had to do with being basically impaled on stakes or crucified even for the public to see. This is a terrible penalty. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So that's remarkable. The king had this event written right in front of him. And why this is important is later in the story, we're going to find out that Mordecai was never rewarded for this deed, for having reported this and foiling this plot. And that was unusual because the Persian kings were very quick to reward those who would be lo show loyalty to them. And it was a mark of honor for them. So the fact that this did not happen with Mordecai was very unusual, even though it was done right in the presence of the king. Well, anyway, moving on to chapter 3, we see the unfolding of a plot against the entire Jewish nation. And it starts in verse 1. "After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Now, we've done some research on that and did some for the Bible reading program and putting together the commentary there. Haman was an Agagite. And what seems likely about this, and Josephus says this is the case, is that he was basically an Amalekite, an Edomite, Amalekite, descended from Agag. Who was Agag? Remember at the time of Samuel and King Saul. Saul was supposed to go down and obliterate the Amalekites because God had said at the time of the Exodus that he would have perpetual war against the Amalekites. And the king of the Amalekites, this Agag, apparently had descendants. And here they show up down through history. And there's supporting material for that to show that Haman was of that descent. So he was a person who already had, based on his past and who he was, a very grave enmity against the Jewish people. And it's interesting too, because I think we can prove from the book of Obadiah that a great number of the Palestinian people today are Edomite as well, and likely Amalekite, especially those who live down in the area of Gaza and some of these other places. So some of these terrorist actions we see is probably part of this ongoing war that God said would be existing till the end of human history, basically, until that breaking point where Christ returns. And in the book of Obadiah, it says there won't be any Edomites anymore, which is for the kingdom period. I guess they'll be in the second resurrection, but it looks like there won't be any during the millennium. But anyway, it's remarkable here that you have this enmity that's already going on. And then if we look down to verses 5 through 7, we see when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him of the people of Mordecai. So there was a lot of Jews. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And notice verse 7, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast poor, that is the lot. Poor is an Akkadian word, and it meant lots, basically, casting lots. Before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month Adar. So this was a long time away. Notice that they did this in the first month, but that they weren't the lot didn't show up until the 12th month. So there were many months until this destruction against the Jews were to happen. The first month being when? Nisan. That's the time of Passover. And we'll see that this was right at the time, by the way, of Passover and unleavened bread here in just a minute. But I want to point out a few things here. Notice verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. So here they are, this people, they're different. They're different. How terrible that is that they're so different. But I found in putting together the commentary for the Bible reading program on Esther, and I recommend this if you have not looked at it, but a good quote that I felt from WorldNet Daily from a Jewish rabbi here in America, Shmuley Botiak, he wrote the following about this. He said, for 2,000 years, the Jews have asked themselves the question, an increasing number of Americans are now asking, why do they hate us? Is it possible that the underlying causes of anti-Semitism are similar to the underlying causes of anti-Americanism? When I lived in Oxford, I heard all kinds of academic theories preferred as to the cause of anti-Semitism, but few seemed as straightforward as the reason given by the first documented genocidal anti-Semite, the biblical Hitler, Haman. In asking King Ahasuerus for the authority to slaughter all the Jews in the ancient Persian Empire, he says, there exists a people dispersed and scattered among the nations and all the provinces of your kingdom, and yet their values are entirely different from everyone else's. Jewish singularity, Jewish peculiarity, a refusal to blend in and be like everybody else is what foments hatred in Haman's breast. Why do you Jews hold yourselves aloof? Why don't you just become like everyone else? Do you think you're better than us? Add to this the Jewish penchant for promoting justice and a steadfast commitment to espousing morality, and you have the perfect formula for hating the foreigner who not only rejects your way of life while living in your country, but makes you feel inferior to boot. The Talmud says that Mount Sinai, literally Mountain of Hatred, was given its name because after the Jews, the Israelites, received the Torah and committed themselves to lives of ethical virtue, the enmity of the world's inhabitants, who now stood out as immoral, descended heatedly upon them. Well, of course, the virulent hatred that the Jewish people have experienced has also been experienced by true Christians. And we know what that's all about. That's God's people, always those who are different, who stand out and receive a certain amount of hatred from the world and the world's leader, Satan the devil. Speaking of Hitler, by the way, I found this interesting. Adolf Hitler banned the Book of Esther and forbade the observance of Purim. He also declared it a capital offense without the possibility of trial for Christians or Jews to possess a copy of the Book of Esther. So I suppose that means I don't think that probably meant that you weren't allowed to have a Bible. Maybe it did. I'm not sure exactly how that worked. But if you had a copy of Esther, I think they would look at that as pretty bad. And also in an apparent connection made by Hitler between his Nazi regime and the role of Haman, he stated in a speech made on January 30th, 1944, that if the Nazis were defeated, the Jews could celebrate a second Purim. So obviously he's even, you know, basically equating himself with Haman and the enmity against the Jewish people that God, you know, set right here through the Book of Esther. Well, moving a little bit further through this, let's look at verse 12. It says, the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written. Notice that, the 13th day. When is that? It's the day before Passover. The very day before Passover is when this decree was written. And then what happened? Well, we see in chapter 4 that finally, Mordecai, you know, immediately went out and fasted. Esther tried to find out what's going on. He informed her of what was happening and got her to agree to go in before the king, but she was going to fast for 3 days and three nights. When was this period? This was during the days of unleavened bread. This was right at the time of Passover and unleavened bread that these events happened, where Esther went and fasted. And after those 3 days, we see in chapter 5 that she did go into the king. And she did not die as was said would happen, if they were not accepted by the king at that time. So she was spared by the king extending his scepter toward her. And then she made an appeal. She wanted the king and Haman to come to a banquet, which is interesting because as you read here in chapter 5, it talks about that. But the king says, well, what do you want from me? What do you want? Up to half my kingdom. And he says, well, tomorrow let's have another banquet and I'll tell you. We don't know why she said that, by the way. We don't know why she didn't go ahead at that banquet and make her case. However, the fact that she didn't make her case allowed some amazing things to happen right after this. Because as you continue in the account here, you find out in chapter 6, verses 1 through 5, that the king couldn't sleep. And so he asked somebody to come and read to him the Chronicles to put him to sleep, evidently. But that's exactly, I think, what the reason was. But as they were reading them, he finds out this story about this plot that had been, foiled against him, and who was responsible. It was Mordecai. He says, so has anything been done for this guy, Mordecai? They said no. And he said, well, what are we going to do? Right at that moment, Haman shows up. Haman shows up at the palace and comes in, and the king says, oh, this is perfect. What should we do to honor the person who really needs to be honored? Haman thinks it's himself, so he paints this grand scenario of leading him through the town, and proclaiming the person's praises. And then lo and behold, the king says, that's what we'll do. You're going to go lead the praises for Mordecai the Jew. So this is absolutely staggering. This story, that would not have happened, by the way, if Esther had not waited till the next day. But she didn't know that was going to happen. But somebody knew that it was going to happen. And that is evidently part of the understanding of what's happening here, is who's really running things, who's really guiding these events. Well, as we follow the account, just to wrap up here, in chapter 7, we see that, and I definitely recommend that you read this, go through and read this over the next, next day or two. This is the time that commemorates this. We see what happened with Haman being hanged or put on this, impaled, basically, instead of what he had planned, which was for Mordecai to be destroyed. But he still had a big problem. The death day for the Jews was still coming up, and it could not be altered by Persian law. But that could be overwritten by some kind of new thing that they would do to negate the first law. And that's what they basically did, and they were able to prepare for it. And this is an interesting thing, brethren. Remember, this this decree happened at the time of Passover, but the events that, you know, the destruction day for the Jews was to come way later, the 12th month, almost the entire year later. And that gave a lot of time to prepare. And how did they determine that 12th month? It was from the lot, remember? And I won't have you turn to this verse, but you can write it down if you want. This is Proverbs 16:33. It says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." That's the interesting thing here. They cast lots, and they were looking to some kind of guidance through chance or circumstance or their pagan gods. But the one who really was able to orchestrate this was the true God, who made it happen the way he wanted to give his people enough time to prepare and deal with that situation. And so they were able to. And when that day finally came, they were ready, and a lot of people joined with them. They took out their enemies, even preemptively in some cases, and were able to deal with the situation. And we see here in chapter 9, I'll just refer you to these verses. You can read them. 9 verses 16 through 22 tells you about the institution of the Feast of Purim to commemorate this. It's called Purim because, again, that means the Feast of Lots, because it commemorates the fact of what actually happened at this time. And it says here in verse 27, "The Jews established and imposed it on themselves and their descendants and all who would join them," all who would join them, so not even just them, "that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year." And that was, the first day was celebrated by the general nation, but there was still fighting on that day in the capital, and so they didn't observe it till the next day. And that was in Shushan. Later, the Jewish people, in trying to keep it a two-day thing, made it that all the Jews outside of Jerusalem do the first day, the Jews of Jerusalem do it the second day. But anyway, according to the written instruction, according to the prescribed time, verse 28, "that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants." So this was a very critical thing to memorialize. It's a Jewish national holiday, like Hanukkah. And it's certainly, it's something that is important for them to commemorate. By the way, they botched it. I was just mentioning to Dr. Halston last night that the Jews, they get totally drunk at Purim, because in the Talmud it says that you're supposed to drink enough so that you no longer recognize the difference between blessed is Mordecai and cursed is Haman. So, and there's, they try to excuse that some kind of ways, but that is basically, a lot of people use that as just a big excuse to get completely blitzed on that day. And then another thing about it is that they do plays of what happened and stuff. They wear masks and they basically have a big bash. And I think they just basically got that from Carnival and Mardi Gras, which happens right around the same time, and they picked up these pagan customs, which again is totally against the point of Purim. The Purim is to show how they were different and God protected them for their difference, and yet they want to blend in and be like the world. That's very tragic. But if we're going to memorialize Purim at all, let's remember what it's all really about. And there is meaning for us too in Purim. I do want us to one thing I really want us to carry away is this. This is a very important point. If it wasn't for what happened at Purim, none of us would be sitting here in this room. I guarantee it. We are here because of what happened then. Because if that had not happened, there would have been no Jewish people. There would have been no Messiah. There would have been no Christianity. There would be nothing of what we have going on right now. Because God delivered his people. He delivered them and he continues to deliver them. And of course, another thing for us is that it's a type of the future victory of all God's people, when God is going to make sure that the ultimate Haman is put down and his people prevail. Let's look forward very much to that day as we think about what happened long ago.